Phil Neame, Reel One. Can you tell me how the news of the Falklands crisis broke with you, please?
I was up on a climbing, well, the whole family were up on a holiday in Scotland. For me, it was a climbing holiday for the rest of the family, sort of swanning around in the valleys over Easter. And we read about the invasion in the paper. I must admit, you know, for a few days beforehand, it had been beginning to generate, it seemed to me, and lots of people were saying, oh, no, it wasn't going to happen. And I mean, I must admit, I thought, well, I don't see why it's not going to happen. So when it the invasion duly did take place, I have to say that, you know, I didn't think it was any great surprise. And I'm trying to remember now, I think I must have rung Aldershot to find out what was going on, and got the word that we were all being recalled, and that H had, I think, already flown back from a holiday in skiing in France, and was busy berating UKLF to convince them that we should be the battalion that was sent, which sounded, you know, fairly good par for the course as far as H was concerned. So we cut the holiday short by a couple of days, as I recall. I went herring back to Aldershot, expecting, really, in a sense, to be moving out any day, only to find actually, you know, there's a great sort of heaving indecision that 3 Power had already been earmarked to go as the spearhead battalion. And the suggestion was that really there wasn't a role for us at this stage, and we could all sort of, you know, relax and get on. Well, H was not prepared to accept that, and by hook or by crook, he eventually got us stood by as the sort of, if you like, the first tranche of reinforcements for the commando brigade. And I think now it must have been some 10 days, 2 weeks later that eventually we did set sail. I suppose it was about a week of swilling around Aldershot, not sure whether we were going to go or not, before it was eventually confirmed. And then things began to happen fairly quickly. I remember we got a Royal Marine captain attached to us, David Constance, who was a real pot of gold, I think, for the battalion. He was a superb individual who effectively took over as deputy operations officer. Chris Keeble started tracking down more machine guns, convinced that actually we needed a pair of machine guns per section, grenade launchers and things like that. All of which, I think the first tranche of troops, the commander brigade and 3 Para had gone down without these sort of additional assets. They hadn't had time. And it's always remarkable to think that this kit was there. All one had to do was ask for it, and it became available. And it was so patently, you know, valuable kit to have. And it always struck me as really rather sort of strange. And I can't help thinking that, you know, in a lot of minds in the Ministry of Defence at this stage, you know, I suspect that very few people were convinced it was actually going to end up in a war. And I suppose even in our minds, when we eventually set sail on the Norland, there was still a lot of real doubt as to whether this was going to end up in a war, or whether it was just going to be a trip down to the equator, get a suntan and cruise back again. And I think there were sort of mixed feelings on that. In the back of our minds, parachute regiment and everything else, we really wanted to test our mettle, have a little war, get stuck in. On one side, if you like, on the other side, obviously all the apprehension that goes with that, and half thinking, yes, it'd be jolly nice just to sort of sail south, get a suntan and come back.
You'd never been in fighting yourself?
I had been, but never at close quarters. In Oman in the late 70s, when I was still in the RAF regiment, I'd done a couple of detachments to Salalah, during the Dhofar War, and that regularly used to get mortared by the Adu, and we used to answer back with our own mortars and track them down with ground radar systems and so on. No, I mean, I think I have to be honest to say, never in a sort of situation where I'd seen the whites of their eyes, in a sense. Okay, Northern Ireland as well, you can say it's active service, but not in the same sort of sense that this was clearly going to be. So, it was, you know, a lot of excitement. And I must admit, you know, I think everyone within the whole battalion was busting a gut to get there. We were getting phone calls from people who'd been posted from the battalion in the previous 6 months, or saying, I want to come back, I want to go. There was definitely not any suggestion of someone sort of saying, oh God, do I really want to go? No, I think to a man we were all committed to going down there. I think, you know, why is probably worth addressing. I think there was an awful lot of sort of stuff about you know, defending the Falkland Islanders and so on at the time, and to be honest, I don't think that was a significant factor in our minds at all. I mean, the reason why we wanted to go was quite simply that for most of us, we'd been training for years for just this sort of eventuality, and I think most of us felt it would be jolly nice to put that training to the test at some stage before we finish our military careers.
And you went in the Norland?
And we went in the Norland, yeah. I think the other factor, too, was that... I think a very dominant factor was the sort of the Maggie factor, really, that, you know, as Maggie said go, and we all, I think, very much felt we were... we're servants of the Queen, but I mean, in these circumstances, I think we're all very sort of acutely aware we were servants of the government, but not the government, very much servants of Maggie. I mean, the leadership that she was providing from the very first days, I think, grabbed everyone's consciousness in a quite dramatic way. I mean, I think that would be true, you know, sort of from H downwards. H was always sort of coming out with sort of extravagant expressions if he didn't agree with something, like, I'll get on the phone to Maggie and sort it. You know, it was definitely a very personal, interesting personal kind of relationship there. But even so, as I say, we really did set off, you know, with the sort of band playing Don't Cry For Me Argentina and all this sort of corny stuff from Portsmouth Dock. Really not that convinced that it was going to end up in a war. And I suppose... The significant thing that changed it, and I'm trying to remember now whether this was before we got to Ascension Island or after, was the sinking of the Sheffield. I think, I mean, from the moment we set sail, we took it very seriously. We trained non-stop on that ship, and I think, again, that bears some real comparison with troops who were sent down later, who one hears, you know, the trip down was treated as, you know, something of a sort of jolly. From the word go, we trained, especially all those things that in peacetime perhaps you tend to sort of push aside, like first aid training and so on. A lot of concentration on that. But even so, in the back of our minds, thinking, you know, it's not really going to happen. You know, the politicians will sort it out, you know, or whatever. And anyway... I think when the Sheffield was sunk, I think the ship suddenly went, for a couple of hours at least, fairly quiet. I think it was that which really suddenly made it very clear that really after something as significant as that and the Belgrano on their side, that really now perhaps there was no going back, and that it was going to end up in at least us going ashore. I think even then there was still a thought that once ashore, then the Argentinians would sort of say, okay, fine, you know, you can have it back anyway, and so on. And I suspect, certainly in the whole sort of strategy of the thing, there was a sort of, there was probably hope all along that once we got ashore, this would happen, that we wouldn't actually have to come to a sort of face on the land. Because when we did go ashore, I mean, certainly for the first 4 or 5 days after we'd secured Sussex Mountain, there seemed to be a complete lack of you know, if you like, medium-term objectives. Right, we're ashore, we've established ourselves on Sussex Mountain. What next? It's always very useful, I think, in situations like that, if especially when, you know, you're living in conditions of some discomfort, you can see why and see what's going to happen next and start to prepare for it and so on. And there was quite simply no orders at all of that sort. It was limbo for 4 or 5 days, and I'm sure it's because I think a lot of people thought, right, get ashore, that's the main goal, okay, and indeed in military terms, in a sense it was as well, but and then let's see what happens, see what the Argentinians do next. And when, of course, you know, there's still no move towards a sort of negotiation or anything else, then they had to, I think, start thinking, you know, more concisely of how the sort of how the objectives would be secured in a military sense. Now, I may be wrong there, but I mean, that was the impression that, you know, sitting on Sussex Mountain as a company commander, that was the impression that I had of the situation. And if you, you know, speak to Julian Thompson, he might say, well, no, all along we had this plan, but well, if he did, it, you know, it wasn't clear at that stage to the troops ashore. And that was the sort of rationale that I had, you know, for it. And indeed, you know, my one soldiers were also asking, you know, what next? And you know, one answered as best one could to the extent that, well, clearly we'll decide when we see what sort of reaction the Argentinians have come up with to our coming ashore.
Can we say something about your own company?
Yes. I'd commanded the company. I'd taken over about 3 or 4 months previously. We'd been on a battalion exercise to Kenya just after Christmas. So I, you know, in that time I got to know them obviously reasonably well, but I was, you know, still felt a relative tyro, I suppose. I was, you know, in company commander terms, I was, you know, very much the new boy that the other two rifle company commanders had been in their posts for, I think, well over a year. So I felt I was probably, you know, had a little bit of catching up to do, and certainly quite a lot to do in terms of getting to know the company.
How were you treated aboard the Norland?
Very well. I mean, the rapport with the civilian crew was absolutely superb. I mean, I think they, in many respects, were unsung heroes of the whole conflict when you consider that, you know, the Norland, more than any other civilian ship, was right in the thick of it and was effectively used as an amphibious assault ship. I think in some ways it was a bit unfortunate that in the early days people didn't level with them, and I can see why they didn't, you know, but eventually when we got, you know, sort of well on the way to the Falklands, well south of Ascension, the order came out that, you know, from this moment all crews, including civilians, were now under naval orders. All right. 2 minutes later came the orders, as I recall, you know, sort of saying, you know, the Norland would be effectively an assault ship. I remember that I think the captain and the crew generally were just a little bit put out that it had been done in this way, that, you know, first of all they had to be put under naval orders and then the orders for their part came out. And I think that they thought, well, you know, they'd just been used a bit here. And I think that I think they felt unflattered. I think that they rather took the view that, you know, look, if people had been straight with us, there's no question. We were already committed. Of course we're going to go in and do the job. We didn't need this sort of threat of naval orders over the top of us to make us do it. And I think there was a certain resentment there, sort of slight sort of poor handling of the sort of morale aspects of it. But, you know, I can see why it happened. It was, you know, it was the safe way to play it, I suppose. But a very, very warm rapport with them developed. One or two amusing bits of it. There was one of the The women had gone ashore at Freetown in the crew, so there was only men on in the crew left. One of them, I think, preferred to dress as a woman and behave as a woman rather than a man. It was quickly christened Wendy by the battalion. But Wendy's saving grace was that Wendy was a superb piano player and entertainer, and a very quick line of wit. And for all Wendy's penchant for non-heterosexual relationships, one heard, the battalion actually took this this man Wendy very much under their wing, and ended up making him a honorary member of the battalion, presenting him a battalion tie and everything else.
Which a battalion mascot.
Almost a battalion mascot. Yes, it seems a bit unkind to say that, but it was just an example of how, you know, the, in a way, partly because of the circumstances we were in, all sorts of prejudices that might in other circumstances have led to a totally different sort of behaviour were sort of, if you like, repressed, or not repressed, but just pushed aside as irrelevant. That was one interesting aspect. And the Captain Don Ellerby, again, I think almost became a sort of father figure. You know, he's sort of grizzled old sea salt. And I remember, you know, when we did go ashore, he came up on the ship's PA system just before we went ashore, and, you know, really in a very moving, simple way, just said, look, it's been great having you aboard, you know, you've been wonderful passengers, you know, have a good trip ashore, and please come back safe, and we look forward to sailing you home. And it was all done sort of slightly as, you know, the sort of standard sort of spiel of a, you know, thank you for sailing with us. But there was obviously much more to it than that, and it was beautifully done. And I remember, it was always created a very distinct, vivid impression in my mind before we went ashore that. You know, and it, therefore, in a way, while we were ashore, almost, you know, Norland became a sort of, you know, the sort of the mothership, the sort of the womb to go back to when it was all over. It was an interesting time, actually. I think the other sort of thing that I remember of the ship, the trip down there, was that, you know, we had sports days to try and sort of alleviate the long periods of training, but at the same time to, you know, keep people's interest in morale and fitness going. And I was nominated as battalion sports officer. And, I mean, the games of sports were fairly devastating. Deck hockey with sort of broomsticks and rolled up socks and things going over the edge, and I had visions of someone following it. And I suppose the sort of the really, we had a sort of steeplechase around the ship, which, you know, the crew who were on sort of night shift got a bit of stroppy about, because it was people sort of running all over their sort of cabin roofs and so on, people vaulting down the companionways to try and gain time, and an orienteering competition, and, you know, sort of orienteering competition on board ship. It was actually a fascinating exercise. It was amazing how easily people got lost and for how long. It was quite interesting. And again, actually, there was a sort of hidden purpose to this, because it got people to know the ship should we actually get sunk and so on, and all the whole business of abandoning ship drills that we had to practice and so on. There was a sort of hidden sort of purpose to, you know, getting people to know their way around the ship. So anyway, we went ashore. We went fully laden. I suppose the least that anyone was carrying was 80 pounds, and I think many people were carrying well over 100 pounds, especially the support weapons people. And it really was the most harrowing move up to the top of Sussex Mountain in with those sort of loads. We kept ourselves very fit, but perhaps not sort of what you call sort of tabbing fit. And there'd been a certain amount of confusion getting ashore. We were about 2 hours late actually getting ashore onto Blue Beach, partly because there'd been some confusion over who was going to which landing craft. I remember I got into mine, and, you know, the guy in charge said, you know, well, I'm, you know, Blue Beach 4, which was the, I think, the southernmost part of our landing area. And I said, no, 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 you're Blue Beach 1. You know, I'm going in at the north end. He said, no, no, I'm Blue Beach 4. Hefting my rifle and saying, you are Blue Beach 1. H, meanwhile, sort of, you know, throwing tracks because it was going much slower than we thought. There was a sort of swell as we stepped out of the ship into the landing craft, and it was all slowing things down. One bloke, I think, had got his leg crushed and so on. So the whole thing was getting a bit fraught and not going quite as smoothly as it should. And, I mean, I suppose, does it ever? And then we got ashore, and, as I recall, the special boat section who was supposed to meet us got the wrong night and therefore turned up the next night when we were all well ashore and so on. What happened is I think John Crossland actually met them as he walked down towards along the shoreline before climbing up to Sussex Mount and met them, and they said, oh, we thought you weren't coming ashore until the following night. There were all sorts of little hiccups. Not that they were sort of, you know, grievous, but it was just, you know, one hiccup after another eventually starts to just sort of slightly undermine confidence. And then this awful slog up the hill with these sort of loads through the peat bogs and so on. It took us far, far longer than we'd anticipated. And, you know, the net result was it was daylight came up and we should have been at the top and already digging in, and we were still only about halfway up Sussex Mountain itself. And that, you know, and still not in position before the Argentinians started to fly their pukas and see what was happening and so on. So that could have been a fairly dodgy situation. I mean, I think fortunately there'd been sufficient diversions elsewhere that clearly the Argentinians were not at this stage too clear as to, you know, where the main effort was going and so on, and were hesitant to go and commit everything in these early days, which could have been fairly critical to the troops going ashore. And then thereafter, even before we really got sort of firmly dug in and so on, it was, at least for us ashore, a bit of a relief to see that actually, of course, the main effort was going to be directed against the ships and not us on shore. I must admit, in the early days, I formed an impression, provided we stayed well dispersed on that sort of ground, the threat of ground attack was not, you know, not all that had been cracked up to be, which was fairly comforting. I think the other thing that came out of it was that it very much put its stamp on how we did our subsequent moves, particularly going into a sort of battle situation, that from that moment on, as a battalion, as opposed to sort of certainly some of the other units ashore, we never tried to move, at least tactically, and especially going into, say, the Goose Green or Wireless Ridge situation, with our large packs. We went on light scales. I say light scales, we're still carrying at least 50 pounds plus on our belts. But, you know, the idea of trying to move with everything, lock, stock and barrel, in those situations, after the experience of Sussex Mountain, we binned entirely, and we decided it was, you know, preferable to be, you know, risk being for a limited period, say 2 or 3 days, you know, cold and wet, rather than weighed down with these monstrous burdens. And I think that was the right way to play it as well, as no doubt in my mind that we did that right and benefited from that lesson. As I say, you know, for several days on top of Sussex Mountain, there was a sort of general lack of direction. You know, no one knew what we were going to do next. Then one started getting rumours of sort of political imperatives coming down from London that, you know, something had to be done. You could see the fleet being sort of bombed to bits in San Carlos water, while we were sort of sitting up on the hilltops waiting for orders. And the first, in that sort of first 10 days or so, my company was stood by for raids further south, first of all to, I'm trying to remember now the name of the place, Camilla Creek. Right, we stood by to do a raid in the area of Port Sussex House, which is a few kilometres south on the coast of Sussex Mountain. And there'd been reports of Argentinians a small Argentinian garrison, that would be the wrong word, outpost there. I think reported in by one of the naval ships. So I sent my 12 platoon under Jim Barry down there to have a look, and it looked like they were going to be the first part of the battalion into action. And anyway, by the time they got there, they found evidence that the Argentinians had been there but were no longer there, and occupied the place. And they then stayed there for a couple of days. We were then warned off for the first time for a raid on Goose Green, and the idea was that I was going to go down and secure Camilla Creek House, and we set off and made arrangements over the radio to RV with 12 platoon en route towards Camilla Creek. And we just made the rendezvous with 12 platoon, and the orders came back, came over the radio that the raid had been cancelled and we were to return. So having got halfway to Goose Green, we then walked back. And one must say that all this sort of stop-start sort of business was hardly conducive to sort of confidence or high morale. More importantly, I think, that I discovered how tender everyone's feet had become, because they literally, I mean, since we'd been ashore, no one had really had totally dry feet. We were doing our best and so on, and even started the old-fashioned bit of feet inspections and so on, which, you know, I thought had gone out with the ark, but suddenly became important again in the conditions we were in. But even so, I mean, we weren't using our feet a great deal. They were getting soft and so on. And this, I don't know, sort of four-mile trek south and 4 miles back that we'd done had clearly taken, in that short time, had taken its toll on our feet in the condition they were in. And I remember saying to H that we really couldn't afford this sort of thing, that we had to start treating our feet a bit like, you know, car tyres, with only so much wear in them in the circumstances, and if we were going to waste that mileage, you know, we were going to have problems. All of which I don't think H took very seriously, but I mean, it certainly, to my mind, it was the most, apart from the sort of whole irritation of the thing, it was the most critical thing. Well, we got back that night, and then we were told, well, it was going to be on after all. It was unbelievable, and we then sort of warned off to be helicoptered down to Camilla Creek House first thing in the morning. So, you know, stop, start, continued. And that morning we all bailed out before first light, lined up in stick order, ready for the helicopters, only to be told, sorry, helicopter's not available, priority task, and the raid had been binned again. And we really were at this stage beginning to think, you know, what on earth's going on? And I think it was probably now, again, working from memory, 2 days later that once again the raid was set up. And I think it's probably quite important to make the point that it was set up as a raid. And sort of early afternoon, I don't know why it was always me. I think just because where I was on Sussex Mountain, I was on the, as it were, the route south. And H got hold of me again and said, right, the raid's back on. You're to go down with your company, secure Camilla Creek House as a assembly area, and you're to get going as soon as possible. And a couple of hours later, we were off in daylight at this stage. I think we probably had about an hour and a half of daylight. We reckon to be about halfway there before dark came in. And in that time, we'd made some preparation. We'd stashed all our SF kits and so on ready to be helicoptered forward. We decided we weren't going to actually take all of those down with us. We took some. And we'd adjusted Camilla Creek House with artillery. And I, for two reasons, really. I thought that we would give it a good pasting before we moved in there. But I also thought it would be quite a useful navigational aid. And when we, it was a very featureless piece of ground as one got off Sussex Mountain. Anyway, I suppose about an hour after last light, we were getting to where I thought would be fairly close to Camilla Creek. I wasn't quite sure how far south on the track we'd gone. I'm just going to have a